I want you to keep writing your letters to the media. Your letters to President Bush. Because I believe you're having an impact. The media is on the defensive for the first time in a long, long time. Late last night, I watched Larry King interviewing Howard Rosenberg, the respected columnist of the Los Angeles Times, and Ed Turner, who directs CNN's news operation. Not Ted, Ed. Rosenberg raised the question, all the time commenting that he respected CNN. He thought that Peter Arnett in Baghdad should be there. I'm not sure I agree with that, but having said those things, he raised the question, can't you be objective? Do you have to be neutral to be objective? That, in essence, was the question he was raising. And doesn't there come a time, and he used the example, if you're confronted with the prisoners of war, obviously beaten, that you can be objective and still be an American? A chilling, very chilling self-exposé came out of CNN's representative in the series of answers that were given on the program. He commented how that they are a worldwide network. What he was trying to say is we are bigger than any one nation. We are an international operation. And our journalists are in many places of the world where the way they handle themselves, and I'm not using the exact quote, but I'm right at the heart of the meaning, can determine their very survival. What he in essence was saying in nice words is that our journalists, since we're international and must report on the whole world, our journalists, and you can be seated in here, our journalists are in some countries where if they are critical or if they identify themselves as American in their leanings, they might get shot. That's what he's really saying. They might not get the kind of treatment in a land that will beat prisoners of war, flaunt Geneva Convention rules, thumb the nose at the world community. Brag that if they catch prisoners, they will be treated in accordance with holy Islamic law, which is defiance of international law, because in holy Islamic law, you can kill the infidel. And in that chilling admission, we have where their heart really lies. They're not an American network. And having made that admission, the price tag that goes with it is they get treated by America as foreigners and cohabitors with the enemy. That's the price tag. You see, they get very American when they take on our side in the briefings. They get very American as they haunt the halls of the Pentagon and the White House and listen to our generals give briefings. They get very American in insisting on their duty to be a proxy for the American people. They get very American in insisting on their First Amendment rights as part of their American privilege. And then they expect the rest of America to smile when they make excuses as to why on the international scene they're afraid to admit they're American or take sides. All their excuses sound pretty hollow to me. And what do you think of a media that listened today as the Pentagon and the generals stated what any person with an ounce of common sense can see? And I thought that Pete Williams did a superb job saying they would not be bound to a flat, unbending 72 hours. But when a plane was missing in action, or pilots were down behind enemy lines, or anyone, they would not report it until the search and rescue team had finished its search and rescue, which normally will not extend beyond 72 hours, but sometimes you'll pick up the beeper tone 12 or 18 hours into the absence, and you don't want to have the search team have to short-circuit its time once having located the beeper. Neither do you want to prolong the agony to families if you have found them and rescued them. You announce that immediately. But any person with decency and common sense would comprehend, what does the American people really want? To suffer the agony and the pain and the loss of a mad rush by the media to be the first to report a plane is down, or give time, since we're dealing with an uncivilized enemy that has already demonstrated what they will do to prisoners of war? Were we fighting, and there still does exist in the world people who will carry on an altercation and do it according to rules, but in a proven enemy situation where that enemy mistreats prisoners, is it too much to ask, forego the race to be the first to say, plane down in enemy territory? Type of plane which sends chills through the families in this nation who know the type of equipment their loved ones are working with. And can't they give silence long enough for the search and rescue operation to complete its work? And yet, in spite of that, what do you think of a media that raced to tell us and show pictures of the transport plane with apparently a dozen special forces abroad that's missing? Now, My hope is it's not missing at all. And that those special forces are sneaking up on them somewhere. But even that bit of information, releasing the fact they are special forces, which you know are designed to go in secrecy behind enemy lines and perform critical commando functions in secrecy. And the media tries to tell us that all they want is to just report the news. In spite of that policy announced today, every network I looked at announced this missing plane. And they're so eager to find out, have women been captured? Because their own perverted, sadistic interest wants them to play on the imagination of what might happen to these in the clutches of these uncivilized troops if a woman falls in their hands. And they won't give the time for search and rescue to complete its basic function. And Howard Rosenberg had the courage to say that he was a bit uncomfortable when they, under the guise of reporting, and I don't use his words, but I come to grips with his meaning, aired unedited a spokesman of the peace group that's been in Baghdad, which turned into nothing but a free polemic against the war, and quite accurately and with incision, Rosenberg pointed out the viewpoint was not something new. It's a viewpoint that's been oft-expressed, and thus it could not be justified by the fact that the one saying those words was saying it on a microphone via a satellite uplink from Baghdad. Well, a weak response of Ed Turner for CNN was, well, it's a point of view. We give other point of views later in the day, and they are in Baghdad. Well, Jim Baker's in prison, and he has a point of view. And it's rather unusual and newsworthy to have a preacher 45 years in prison. You think they would play a polemic by him, unedited? And Rosenberg asked a very incisive question. Did you review that tape before it played? No, we played it live. They wanted that viewpoint heard. They didn't play it for the public. What they did was find an excuse. Losing the battle in the streets, knowing their credibility can no longer withstand the knowledge of the American public that their featuring of the anti-war demonstrators was a biased presentation of less than 12% of the viewpoint of America. They seized upon another opportunity to give it prominence on the weak-kneed argument that this viewpoint was being expressed from Baghdad. So they become propaganda machine for Saddam, then propaganda machine for a piddling little handful of peacenik freakos that happen to be in Baghdad. not giving us a byline before it started, by the way, that a large part of those that were there bummed rides, not having the money, bummed rides with the newsman coming out. And big deal. Schwarzkopf was right. Like a gnat on the back of an elephant. About a week ago, I watched CNN pool tape and other network pool tape of Kofke vacant. If you'll think back, in the first days, first week of the war, they showed pictures of this borderline transit overhead four-lane, two-way directional border passing. They showed pictures of this town that had been abandoned. How did Saddam find out it was abandoned? So knowing the town was abandoned, desperate to do something that can turn the tide, knowing that he's pretty much failed because of the Patriot missiles to have bodies in the streets as a result of the Scud missiles, not being able to suck in the Americans to an early ground war, taking a beating now where his troops are dug in, of long trenches from B-52 strings of bombs, three side by side in a wedge-shaped formation, dropping bombs in such a way that craters 35 feet deep and the length of a football field wide are, I don't mean an occasional crater, I mean just like a bulldozer went through and plowed out 35 feet deep and 300 feet wide, just a long trench. I mean, Saddam didn't have to dig those trenches to put oil in. There'll be plenty of trenches when the carpet bombers finish. So how can he gain a propaganda hit, move into a village that's unoccupied? How did he know where the Saudi troops were positioned? That anyone knows or not, as seasoned ground fighters and not as well equipped as the U.S. Marines. He watches CNN. Rosenberg asked, do they pay for the CNN service? And if they do, isn't that a violation of the embargo? I thought there was a little too long a pause by the CNN representative before he said, no, they pirate the signal. I wonder if they file suit in international court in The Hague. So he watches CNN and he moves in the other networks and he knows where they can occupy a town. There's nobody there. I mean, my Lord, they haven't had a bath in 8 months. And here's a hotel with nobody in it. Bathtubs all over the place. Military experts, and I'm beginning to get the feeling that they've learned how to report the war with the Sunday afternoon sportscasters. Because you have these war games experts and these military experts and these military magazine editors and these retired generals that... I notice that the closer they are to recent service, the more aware they are of how adequate the American forces are. The ones that retired somewhere before the First World War still talk about it being a close contest. But you have these war games experts, retired specialists in various elements of the forces, paid, I'm sure, big fees by the networks to sit on the TV every night and draw, just like you see the ex-coaches drawing the play after it happened on Sunday afternoon football. You have them draw on the ways in which this war is going to go, the way in which our troops move around, the possible ways in which we can take on Saddam, or the possible ways in which he can survive. Now, they've had Soviet advisors. But now, all Saddam and his generals have to do is sit in a bunker, turn on the networks, and they can take advantage of the best military minds that the networks can assemble to chalk out and diagram the alternative plans, the game plans, the way to work the plays, the war games on the television set each night. No opposing force in the world has ever been able to sit in their planning bunker every night and watch all the non-occupied military brains that can be assembled in the United States and Europe brought on a television screen to plan the options and the alternatives that the enemy, I'm sorry, I don't give them credit for being that smart, with this great military machine that they could not knock out Iran in 8 years and could not blow Israel, that they desire to do it so much, off the map after Israel wiped out their nuclear plant. I'm sorry, they're not as great as they've been touted up to be. Yet in spite of all that help that the media has given, they would make a big deal today, starting out with 12, having to correct it to 11. Marines are killed. And that becomes such a super big deal, and it is serious when anybody dies. And thank God the memorials will be where the families want it, rather than cameras on Dover, seeing them come out of the plane. Do you realize that at least 77 vehicles, 34 tanks and the balance and other armored vehicles, totaling 77 vehicles confirmed to date and probably more, were knocked out in this attempt to take an unoccupied town? That's 77 vehicles to 2. We kill more tanks than they did people. God knows how many's been killed since Schwarzkopf decided to put the planes in there that were like a swarm of gnats the most dangerous thing facing the planes was running into each other. And they still, in order to report the other side, when I saw file tape that proved that newsmen were up there along the wall where the firing was going on, they still, to give the other side and cater to propaganda, will include in their reports what Baghdad is saying, great victory in Kafki. Thousands of Americans laying in the streets. When they know what the truth is and will not eliminate those blatant lies from their reports. And then like bloodthirsty dogs, one of the network channels made a big deal out of showing the first dead body in the street. It was an Iraqian, thank God, but they had to show a dead body as if we couldn't live if we didn't have that monumental event of the first dead body. I do not believe that America wants to look at dead bodies. Yet, the media tonight thought it was some major coup to show the first dead body lying in a street. And Kafki. So it's the media I'm directing my marks toward tonight, my remarks toward, my marks too. And if you want me to continue, you get on a telephone for one song, then I have some more things to say. If the media had not served Saddam Hussein's purpose so well, he would not have invited others in. It's axiomatic, self-evident. One of the justifications I heard on one of the talk shows regarding why they're keeping Peter Arnett there is that they want to have a contact with Saddam in case he wants to surrender. You know, both the head of Germany and Japan found a way to do it. And when it came time, this so-called first ground war, they come in, take a city that the media told them was unoccupied, position themselves in that city, and anyone knows that the most difficult fighting that you do is house-to-house fighting to drive someone out of a city. And still we hear the reports that their commanders told them if they didn't go, they'd shoot them. I mean, that's real morale, folks. Your commanders tell you, you go attack the other side or we'll shoot you. It wasn't an Alamo. 160, last I heard, surrendered. That hardly compares to the Alamo. We're talking about heroic fighters. And they've been cleaned out. They moved in, took a city that was unoccupied, lost more tanks than we did people, turned and fled in the other three excursions. Three of the armored brigades couldn't find the city. And then went back and got so scared they were running into their own mines, they stopped for fear they'd run into their own minefield. Now this fool, Saddam, in his megalomania, is going to marshal another attack. Because he knows that the media is hunting for dead bodies to put on cameras. I want the song to play when I finish about the evening news and the question in the operating room, is the head dead yet? He knows that he can only win this with the media's help. He has a million-man army, an air force that's fleeing, soldiers that have to be told to fight or be shot, his supply lines being cut off, craters being dug where his bunkers used to be. So the only weapon that's really working for him is the media. And he has to feed them pictures of dead bodies. So he will attack again. He'll come out of those bunkers and send his cannon fodder people that he cares nothing for across that line again, if he hasn't already, while I'm talking. We get into artillery fights, and their artillery's no more. We shoot down every plane that comes up. We have their Scuds on the run. It's taken them a lot longer time now to assemble enough of them in one place to shoot a half a dozen like they used to. The media sits there with their little war games and their little TVs with the remote controls that draw lines on the screen, playing their Nintendo games every night. Well, someone sent me what must have been a copy of the letter. I know that Bush ultimately published the letter that Aziz would not deliver to my president, as he called him. Because it didn't have respect. But I still think this must have been the one that Aziz read. I'm going to have to censor it. From the United States of America, Washington, D.C. My dearest President Hussein, from George Bush, I hope this letter reaches you in the best of health. I think of you often, so I decide to write you this letter to let you know I'm doing well, and so is Barb. I understand we don't exactly see eye to eye on this Kuwait thing, but I'm sure after I explain my feelings on the matter, you will undoubtedly see my point. I guess I should just get straight to the meat of the matter and say, read my lips. Get the bleep out of Kuwait, you raghead son of a camel bleeping beat, before I turn... Now, wait a minute. I got a sense of this. Somebody on the news and on the media has got to take sides. And in case anybody doesn't know that I'm an American and which side I'm on, I'm revealing the letter that the whole world should have heard. Now, I have to censor it because I'm on television. But you know that the bleeps, you can fill them in yourself. I guess I should just get straight to the meat of the matter and say, read my lips. Get the bleep out of Kuwait, you raghead son of a camel bleeping bleep, before I turn loose my Air Force and make a multinational parking lot out of your piece of camel bleep country, and then send the bleeping Army and Marines in to paint the bleeping lines on it, or the bleeping lines on it. I won't need my Navy, because by that time your sorry bleep will be sitting next to Allah, and you won't be concerned about too much of anything anymore. Now, do you think you understand my meaning? Well, Barb is calling me to dinner, so I'll close now. Give my best to the other little ragheads. Keep in touch. All my love, George. Wait a minute. P.S. I hear the old camel is pregnant again. I guess you still have it. Congratulations. Now, the media has been picking these few people that they can find, giving speeches to the boys that, I guess, well up tears in their eyes because they aren't much designed to make a fighting man get out and fight. I happen to have the original speech of General George S. Patton, Jr. to his Third Army on the eve of the Normandy invasion that was selectively picked for that famous speech that George Scott did in the opening of the movie. Patton, if you'd like, I can, I'll have to bleep it too, but I can read you the unadorned, bleeped a little bit, original, if you'd like to hear it. Well, you don't get the only vote. I want to hear from them, too. Somebody said, I just got on the end of that letter. Can I hear it again? Yeah, I'll read it again, I think. Marina Del Rey, Doc, CNN scrambles their signal using a system called DMAC. This is the most sophisticated scrambling system available. If Saddam is watching CNN, CNN must be giving him the scrambling code, and the public has the right to know. Well, I'll read George's letter to you one more time. You can understand why Aziz didn't want to deliver it to him, if this is the original. I just, you know, I just report it when it comes in my hand. United States of America, Washington, D.C., my dearest President Hussein. And again, I must bleep it out. I hope this letter reaches you in the best of health. I think of you often, so I decided to write you this letter to let you know I am doing well, and so is Barb. I understand we don't exactly see eye to eye on this Kuwait thing, but I'm sure, after I explain my feelings on the matter, you will undoubtedly see my point. I guess I should just get straight to the meat of the matter and say, read my lips. Get the bleep out of Kuwait, you rag. Now, you know I'd say hell. Don't you? Get the bleep out of Kuwait, you raghead son of a camel bleepin' bleep, before I turn loose my Air Force and make a multinational parking lot out of your piece of camel blit country. I said blit, didn't I? Your camel blit country. And then send the bleepin' Army and Marines in to paint the bleepin' lines on it. I won't need my Navy because by that time your sorry bleep will be sitting next to Allah and you won't be concerned about too much of anything anymore. Now, do you think you understand my meaning? Well, Barb is calling me to dinner, so I'll close now. Give my best to the other little ragheads. Keep in touch. All my love, George. P.S. I hear the old camel is pregnant again. I guess you still have it. Congratulations. Now, we just have two to go, and that can be reached by 11 o'clock West Coast time, 5 minutes from now, and I can read to you General George S. Patton's original speech, not the doctored up one, the movie used, and that was pretty good. Correll, Minnesota. We only have one person from our little town of 80 people. One person over in Saudi Arabia, and she is a 19-year-old, dear to everyone's heart. After the news spoke about a woman missing in the desert, our whole town was shaken by sadness and fear, wondering if it was her. It is true the media should have the decency to wait for the search and rescue to respond. Now, you can die down and figure you've done your duty by writing a letter or two. You got to keep the pressure on. Just write another letter. Use your middle name this time. Hollywood, how come the media doesn't call Saddam a bleeper for calling for the assassination of Mubarak of Egypt? Because they have a double standard. And Columbus, Montana says, remember Hitler's reporter as Rapien and another traitor, Tokyo Rose? Both were charged with treason after World War II. Think about it, folks. And if you want to hear George S. Patton speak his mind to the boys heading for war on the eve of the Normandy invasion, Berkeley, Pastor, I heard on the news report today, shortly after the media reported the plane going down, that the men aboard the plane had top secret military information. Where in the hell they got that information, I don't know. They got it from a traitor. A traitorous informant. That's who they got it from. It was bad enough to say they were special services, because that in itself telegraphed that they would have top secret military information. Now, the media knows that we're dealing with a brutal reincarnation. I don't believe in reincarnation, but in terms of thought process and dedication, literally a student of Hitler, a merciless outlaw, so damn insane. I got that from a caller, some smart people out there. Gave him a new name, so damn insane. They know that he will torture. Torture beyond belief with that information. The media has access to the Amnesty Report, Amnesty International, of their torture practices. Saddam Hussein is a specialist at. Then the media justified reporting this by saying that Saddam would have tortured them to extract that information. Therefore, they're not telling anything that he isn't going to get by torture anyway, thereby putting the men's life in further jeopardy. San Marcos, Texas, I found you on my shortwave set looking for information on the war. The TV makes me sick. You are a revelation. You make more sense than anyone I've heard for a long time. This is the first time I've listened, and you can bet it will become a habit. Good. All right. 9785 on your shortwave radio. I'm so sick of TV, I may go off of it for a while, so you better get yourself a shortwave radio. Yes, sir. And I'm serious. Anybody listening to me that doesn't care enough to go out and buy a shortwave radio, 9785, you deserve to turn the TV on some night and find we're not there anymore. Either buy yourself a dish so you can watch me off satellite 24 hours a day, Westar 5 Transponder 1X, or get yourself a shortwave radio, 9785, and listen every night. Hollywood, that letter blessed me. 1610 is coming in very clearly tonight, Port Arthur, Texas says. Don't forget 1610 a.m., that clear channel station out of Anguilla in the Leeward Islands, British West Indies. And everyone should try it every night, see if you can pick up 1610 a.m. And I like people to let me know when you're picking it up. General Patton's speech to his Third Army just before the Normandy invasion. The corps chaplain gave the invocation. While the men stood with bowed heads, asking divine guidance for the great Third Army so that they might speed victory to enslaved Europe. Major General Cook then introduced Lieutenant General Simpson, whose army was still preparing for their part in the war. "We are here," said General Simpson, "to listen to the words of a great man, a man who will lead you into whatever you might face with heroism, ability, and foresight. A man who has proved himself amid shot and shell, as Schwarzkopf has. My greatest hope is that someday soon I will have my own great army fighting with him side by side." General Patton arose and strode swiftly to the microphone. How many of you know that he grew up right over here in Pasadena? Courted his wife, met her as a girl on Catalina. General Patton arose and strode swiftly to the microphone. The men snapped to their feet and stood silently. Patton surveyed them grimly. "Be seated." The words were not a request, but a command. The general's voice rose high and clear. "Men, this stuff you hear about Americans wanting to stay out of this war and not wanting to fight is a lot of bull bleep. Traditionally, Americans love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble player, the fastest runner, the big league ball players, the toughest boxers. The American loves a winner and cannot tolerate a loser. Americans despise cowards. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. For the very thought of losing is hateful to an American." He paused and looked over the silent crowd. "You are not all going to die. Only 2% of you here in a major battle would die. Death must not be feared. Every man is frightened at first in battle. If he says he isn't, he's a GD liar. It's hard not to do it the way he did it. Some men are cowards, yes, but they fight just the same and get the hell scared out of them watching men who do fight and who are just as scared as they. The real hero is the man who fights even though he is scared. Some get over their fright in a few minutes under fire. Some take hours, and for some it takes days. The real man never lets the fear of death overpower his honor, overpower his duty to his country, and his innate manhood. All through your career of army life, you men have bitched about what you call this chicken bleep drilling. That's all for one reason. Instant obedience to orders. And it creates instant alertness. I don't give a damn for a man who's not always on his toes. You men are veterans or you wouldn't be here. You are ready. A man, to continue breathing, must be alert at all times. If not, sometimes some German son of a bleep will sneak up behind him and beat him to death with a sack full of bleep." The men roared. Patton's grim expression did not change. "There are 400 neatly marked graves somewhere in Sicily," he cried, "all because one man went to sleep on his job." He paused and the men grew silent. "But they're all German graves. So we caught the bleepers asleep before they knew it." The G
General clenched the microphone tightly, his jaw out thrust. He said, "An army is a team. Lives, sleeps, eats, and fights as a team. The individual heroic stuff's a lot of bleep. The bilious bleeper who wrote that kind of stuff for the Saturday Evening Post didn't know any more about real battle than he did about bleeping." The men slapped their legs and rolled with glee. This was the old boy as they imagined him to be, and in rare form, too. "We have the finest food, finest equipment, best-spirited men in the world," he bellowed. He lowered his head and shook it pensively, and suddenly slapped his hand facing the men belligerently. He said, "Why, by God, I actually pity those sons of bleepers we're going up against. By God, I do." The men clapped and howled delightedly. There'd be many a barracks tale about the old man's choice phrases. This would become part of a parcel of Third Army history. "My men don't surrender. I don't want to hear of a soldier under my command getting captured unless he's hit. Even if you are, you can still fight back, and this is not bull bleep either. Kind of man I want's like a lieutenant in Libya, who with a Luger against his chest jerked his helmet off, swept the gun aside with the other hand, and busted hell out of the Boche with the helmet. Then he jumped on the bum, went out and killed another German. By this time, the man had a bullet through his chest. That's a man for us." He halted, and the crowd waited. And all the real heroes are not storybook combat fighters either. Every man in the army plays a vital part. Every little job essential to the whole scheme. What if every tank driver suddenly decided he didn't like the whine of a shell and turned yellow and jumped headlong into a ditch? What if every man said they won't miss just one man in thousands? What if every man said that? Where in hell would we be now? No, thank God, Americans don't say that. Every man, every department, every unit is important to the vast scheme of things. The ordnance men are needed to supply the guns, the QM to bring up the food and the clothes for us. For where we're going, there isn't a hell of a lot for us to steal. Every man in the mess hall, even the one who heats the water to keep us from getting diarrhea, has a job to do. Even the chaplain's important, for if we get killed and he isn't there to bury us, we'd all go to hell. Each man must think not only for himself, but think of his buddy fighting beside him. We don't want yellow cowards in this army. We don't want them to go back to the States after the war and breed more like them. Brave men will breed brave men. One of the bravest men I saw in the African campaign was one of the fellows I saw on top of a telegraph pole in the midst of furious fire while we were plowing toward Tunis. I stopped and asked him what in the hell he is doing there at a time like that. He answered, "Fixing the wire, sir." "Isn't it a little unhealthy right now?" I asked. He answered, "Yes, sir. I'm going to do it. But this goddamn wire's got to be fixed." You should have seen those trucks on the roads, Gabe's. The drivers were magnificent. All the day they drove along those son-of-a-bleeping roads, never stopping, never diverting from their course, while shells burst all around them. We got through on good American guts. Many of the men drove over 40 consecutive hours. The general paused, staring challengingly out over the silent seas of men. You could hear a pin drop anywhere on the vast hillside. The only sound was the breeze stirring in the leaves and the animated chirping of the birds in the branches off the general's left. "Don't forget," Patton barked. "You don't know I'm here at all." Because you know the story, you that know your history, they'd use Patton to trick the Germans into thinking that he was going to lead a landing somewhere else. "Don't forget," Patton barked, you don't know I'm here at all. No words of the fact are to be mentioned in any letter. The world is not supposed to know what the hell they did to me. I'm not supposed to be commanding this army. I'm not supposed to be in England. Let the first bleepers to find out be the goddamn Germans. Someday I want them to rise up on their hind legs and howl, I gotta do it. Jesus Christ, it's a goddamn Third Army and that son of a bleep Patton again. We want to get the hell over there, Patton yelled. We want to get over there and clean the thing up. Then we'll have to take a little jaunt against the purple bleeping Japanese and clean their nest out before the Marines get all the credit. The crowd laughed, and Patton continued quietly. Sure, we all want to get home. We want this thing over with. But you can't win a war laying down. The quickest way to get it over is to go get the bleepers. The quicker they are whipped, the quicker we go home. The shortest way home is through Berlin. There's one thing you will all be able to say when you go home. You may thank God for it. Thank God that at least 30 years from now, when you're sitting around the fireside with your brat on your knee and he asks what you did in the Great World War II, you don't have to say, I shoveled bleep. And that's the original, with a few bleepers that pain me considerably to have to put in. Thought you'd enjoy that tonight. The shortest way home. The shortest way home for our troops is through Kuwait. And the shortest way to peace is to fly 7,000 miles and smoke a camel. I get on telephone. Winsboro, Texas, from the Dallas Morning News. The Iraqi president may be infuriated by President Bush's pronunciation of his name. Linguistic experts tell New York Magazine that with the accent on the second syllable, Saddam means learned one or leader. I've also heard it means one who confronts. But a native Egyptian says, the way Mr. Bush pronounces it, it means a boy who fixes or cleans old shoes, and it's the dirtiest possible insult in some parts of the Arab world. Isn't that wonderful? And they say George Bush is not a great communicator. He sure has put that one to bed. You're on telephone.